1:20. It's Cinco de Mayo, and it's I said 1:20. We've got five items on the, we have Cinco items on the agenda for Cinco de Mayo. And present for the record, we have Cinco members. We have Representative Gruenberg, Guerra, Coghill, Dahlstrom, and myself, McGuire. And we do have a quorum to conduct business. We're going to go in this order today. We have to end at 3, so I'm hoping to the extent that everybody can be as efficient as possible. I understand, get your ideas and thoughts out there, but try to be efficient. If you have amendments, try to put them in writing. Vanessa can run them out to the copier. We have to get House Bill 193 out, licensing medical and care facilities. That's first up. I promised Representative Sisna 3 minutes to let us understand a part of the bill that she had wanted in that we're not going to put in, but I've committed to her to continue looking at, and I know the department has as well. And the next we're going to go to Vanessa, did we decide to do 137 before workers' comp?
That's what you had told
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Sorry. So SB 137, SB 135, and then SB 130. And SB 20 is also on the list. So we'll march through them as quickly as we can. I don't think 137 and 135 should take too long. But again, if there are amendments or things, we may have to set them aside to get them worked out, because I do want to get workers' compensation out of here today. Okay, without further ado, Representative Sisna. And then I'll have the department present the bill.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Sharon Sisna, District 22 representative, and with me is Cindy Folsom. And probably the first question I'd like to ask you, Madam Chair, is do you have a CS that does or does not include the language, and it was the last CS I had seen was section 54 on page 42, and it was version Y.
So we do still, Representative Sisna, have the version that includes your portion, and then we have an amendment to remove it.
Okay, and Madam Chair, I might suggest to the committee members they might want to look at 42 and just get an idea of what it says. I'm going to explain what this section does and explain why we felt very strongly that we put the amendment in that we did in the HES committee. And as you can see from the slide, that the purpose of this is to keep seniors home, to keep them in their own homes, and that through home health care, through having people at home, you save money. The federal policy has been least restrictive. That has been their policy. That is the push that they've made to states. And Alaska has been answering that push through what's called the PCA, the personal care attendants. The problem with that is the costs have risen extensively. And in just a minute, I'm going to show you the chart on that and show exactly how that happened and how it plays into this. The department in the last year predominantly met this challenge by capping such services as respite care and other things that they haven't capped, as to my understanding, the personal care attendants yet, and they can correct that. But that has been one of the ways that they have addressed this the rising costs. The problem that we have found is that what I have found in the numerous people that I have talked to is that these cuts and caps have jeopardized seniors staying in their home. There is a certain, and probably rather than go on about other things that that we could talk about. I think the best thing.
Also, leave, if you don't mind, if you could leave now or at some other point a copy of your PowerPoint so that members could read even more of the details later.
Absolutely. I'm sorry. I guess we didn't. Oh, you've got them. Oh, yeah, you've got them. Yeah, good. I thought we had. We have so many pieces of paper. Yeah. Thank you. And we're now on page four. And so, first of all, I'd like to introduce you to one woman of many people that I've talked to who's a really good example of this. And this is Sally's mom. Sally is has been working full-time at a bank, and she her mother has Alzheimer's, already qualifies for the Medicaid waiver, and so she could actually go to a hospital tomorrow. She could go to a nursing home tomorrow. She could go to the most expensive kind of care tomorrow. But that's not what Sally wants. She wants her mom at home. She wants her in a loving environment. And she wants and she wants to be able to take care of her mom. Probably next slide at this point. And let's look a little bit at kind of what the situation is. The household is they've got a chair in going down the stairway. They've done everything they can do to make that house friendly and safe for her mom. But now, for instance, right now, she's going by the stairway that you're going to hear about in a minute. She has a healthcare worker a PCA, that comes in, looks at kind of health things, helps her bathe, looks out for problems, helps her move around and get dressed. But she only can get that PCA for, as I understand, let's see, how many does she have? That's the next slide. But she gets her for 26 hours.
What exactly do you fear leaving your mother home alone?
It's a safety issue now because she is not stable. And there's stairs. Yeah, granted, we got a chair lift that if she goes from her chair to the bathroom, which is, approximately 12 feet, there's still that possibility that she could lose her balance and go right down the stairs, or even fall in the bathroom, or even fall out in the front room. And so it's a safety issue, and it's a safety factor that I'm more concerned with than anything else.
As of May, the plan had changed, and you can see in that slide on page 6, the previous plan had her covered for 50 hours a week, which meant that she could go to work, come home, put in her 40 hours, has a very demanding job, and be able to go out and get groceries. So,
was it you that asked the question to her?
Yes, that was...
Star in journalism.
You think I have a future after this? Well, after this, I may need it. No, I'm kidding. But what happened after the new regulations kicked in, and actually, as I recall, there were a number of several months, I think, that went by, and her plan ended, and they had to negotiate a new plan. The new plan is the current plan, and it covers only 30 hours a week. Well, Sally has had to cut back 10 hours a week. She gets paid 10 hours a week less. That may, as a matter of fact, I didn't ask her, but it may jeopardize her health insurance. It affects both of them.
So we're at 9 minutes, Representative Sisna. I really don't mean to do this to you, but if there's a way you could just wrap up. And
I can wrap up really.
I thought it was.
The really important thing is from the department's numbers itself, there is an enormous difference between what is being paid to the 1,000 some hundred people, and it's in this document, that actually qualify for the most intensive. they could go there at any time, and if, in fact, people are losing their jobs and losing their own benefits, like Sally, you're going to wind up having them go to the $330 a day as opposed to the new numbers, which is $65 a day. That's the difference. Now, you've got some wiggle room. This is, the department says that the legislature has given us the intent to cut this program back. I'm saying, boy, we cut this one back, and we're going to see a problem that is more severe, and you'll see it on the side of the nursing home beds. You're going to see a great increase with nursing home because that's what they're qualified for. And what this amendment did was merely put in something into the waiver program, within the waiver program, and I've got the documents right here that actually make this legal, to keep people at home at the competitive price that keeps the at-home care much less than actually either assisted living or nursing home. But nursing home is so much higher.
Right.
And that's the bottom line. And actually, the PowerPoint walks you through it.
Well, I sure appreciate it, Representative Sista, and I know you've worked diligently on senior issues, and not just as the sum of what you've done, but you've been a real advocate, and I appreciate it. I've worked with you and look forward to it during the summer, because I know that this issue is on people's minds, and it is related to the nursing home, assisted living homes, pardon me, in the sense, again, that it may be a less expensive alternative ultimately than nursing homes. And so I appreciate it, and I know members will continue to peruse it, and if there are questions that you have for Representative Sista, you know, during the interim, I think you're going to be, aren't you going to be working a little bit on it in the interim?
I may be working on this nonstop until we fix it, because this is draining about 300, it could drain $370 a day times however many people we lose, and it also jeopardizes the caregivers that are going to give up after having lost a lot of their personal assets before it happens.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Kira?
Just one quickly, and I guess I support Representative Sista's attempt at trying to get this program started, because we had all last summer to deal with this as the fallout from the cuts to chore services and respite home services started to be felt. And I have a question for you, Representative Sista. I know respite care, the department has already cut to just 10 hours a week. What have they cut chore services to?
They cut chore services. Chore services, as I recall, it's 10 hours a week. The big thing about respite is it can not be used when people are at work. So that's what, you know, if it could be used during the at-work time, then you'd wind up with the 40 hours. But that's the catch.
Well, Representative Sista, whatever we can do to continue to help you, and I know you really, I appreciate all of your advocacy. I know you've done a lot of work, and I know the department is going to be working with you too, listening to your ideas. So thank you. And thank you to your staff as well. Okay, so that brings us to House Bill 193, and Dr. Monsonger is here. And I only have, at this moment, one person to testify on it in Anchorage. So if you're here to testify on House Bill 193, go ahead and sign in. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairwoman McGuire and members of the committee. I was noting before Representative Anderson walked in that we were on fives. Today is the fifth month, the fifth day, and the fifth year of the century, too. So. It now changed to.
I thought I could bring that to your attention through my entrance.
Yes. And just to stay on the theme of fives, I'd like to take just a few minutes to introduce House Bill 193, which was the governor's bill, a companion bill. It has been moving through the Senate and just passed out on the Senate floor a half an hour ago, Senate Bill 125. This bill is being introduced for three main purposes. The first purpose is to deal with an incredible statutory and regulatory variation around the multiplicity of types of organizations and entity that the Department of Health and Social Services licenses or certifies. And the intent is to simplify, streamline for agencies that have differing types of work that they deal with department to make it more standard and more straightforward. The second goal is to also standardize across all the various entities and individuals that work for those entities the kinds of background checks that are done before employment to work toward improving the health and safety of vulnerable Alaskans. And the intent is to deal both on the criminal side with criminal background checks and on the civil side with fraud, abuse, neglect, and Medicaid fraud, both for entities, for the organizations, the CEOs, and for the individuals that work with those with clients.
On that point, briefly, Dr. Monsinger, too, I want to let the committee know, because all the members that are sitting here have an interest in and have expressed an interest in different points in predators of children. And one of the things that you shared with me that I think is exciting is the idea that this system, when it comes together, may well be affordable and accessible to a lot of the volunteer nonprofit programs out there that, frankly, in the past have wanted to do background checks, have wanted to really understand where these individuals are coming from and to make sure they're safe with kids. And between the FBI check and then the state check, it's just too costly. And so that was I just wanted to, while we're on that point, share that with the committee, our discussion, that that's one of the broader goals.
If the committee will look at, like I've testified when I've testified here before, that you have a handout that is some PowerPoint slides. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all of these. I just want to highlight just a few points in this presentation. You can peruse it at your leisure.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
I seem to have at least...
Yes, you have two different documents. One is a series of amendments, and that's the. They're both dated 5-4.
If you look, I have one dated 4-29, too.
You shouldn't need that one.
Okay. Can we just check that? Never mind.
Thanks. They should both be
we
dated.
We have two dated, so I need both of these.
We were prepared to testify last week, and the hearing wasn't able to be, so we updated things. If you look at this series of slides that is numbered and just pages through some of the information, if you look at page 3, it's just some examples of types of problems that exist across the country. There's a bullet there about what happens and this is from our state, a supported living home provider was misappropriating funds from residents, and those homes aren't licensed. No background review had been done of that provider before this happened. In other cases, in other states, there's criminal and violent activities, and the person is found then a few months later working in another assisted living home in another place. Personal care attendants right now in our state can be employed by a multiplicity of agencies. They have to do background checks, and they have to do background checks for every single employer they do. By doing this, we can make this available to one place, and all the employers that employ that individual can get the information at one place without having to do individually. If you look at page 4, right now the department licenses or certifies 19 different programs. There's 12 different statutory schemes. Some of the, depending upon when they came up in history and what got put into statute, some of these have most of their rules in statute. Some are mostly in regulation. For example, hospitals have most of their rules in regulation. Assisted living homes have most of their homes in statute. Hospice, depending upon whether you're for-profit or non-profits, one type has rules in statute, the other type has rules in regulation. So there's this big multiplicity that, depending as the decades have gone by, as this has all developed. With Executive Order 108 at the beginning of this administration, an attempt has been started to bring together the licensing and certification activities in the Division of Public Health that doesn't pay for activities, and that's how come I'm presenting this bill. And you can see on page 5 the different types of activities that have been brought together already in the division to separate it within the department from the payment side, so we create some internal tension within the department, balancing out the life and safety and health issues and the reimbursement side, and then have an internal tension that the commissioner then has to resolve, and some independence with our different division directors. So that's also in the background here behind what's going on. Page 6 just highlights some of the variation in rules for different types of organizations that we license and certify. One of the things you'll see there is there are some starred items that aren't licensed, but that with this bill, if it does pass, well, now all those entities and the individuals will be subject to background checks, and they currently aren't. other than personal care attendants. Page 7 just shows some of this many, many statutes that are going to be changed by this, and this is why every time we've made amendments as we move through the legislative journey, and it's why the amendment number 1 you have in front of you is so long, is renumbering goes on all over the place every time an amendment happens. So what's in this bill? I said the goal of it on page 8 highlights what's in the bill. The second bullet is an article that's included now that's new.
Where are we putting
Representative Gruenberg.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, we're on page 8 of my presentation, just as an introduction. There's a new article now that's created in statute to centralize the background checks and registry functions. In my own thinking about this, I think about this in two different parts. Background checks is the criminal side, what's available to the public if you know how to go to court and find it, and will be a gathering together of what's gone in a person's criminal background. And then in regulation, there will be some permanent bars to employment depending on certain crimes, and there will be temporary bars to employment for other crimes. And it'll be modeled on what exists in regulation right now for assisted living. The other part of it is looking at the civil side. We're calling it a misconduct registry, and it's modeled on what's currently exists for certified nurse attendants that work in nursing homes and assisted living right now. It exists in statute just for that one employment class, to look at fraud, abuse, neglect, and we'll be adding Medicaid fraud to that registry. And that registry will be private, but will be available to employers of these different organizations. They can get password access. And so if I come in to apply for a job, the HR person, human resources person, with password access can check and see whether I've had any reports on the registry that would prevent employment. So the key provisions are on page 9, the barrier conditions, as I talked about. All service providers with direct patient contact will be background checked, including volunteers who have regular contact, and the confidential employee misconduct registry. And then there's a waivers process and a standard appeals process. One of the questions that has come up in another committee in the other body was, what happens if somebody is involved in a domestic violence situation, charges are raised, and then the charges are dropped. It'll surface during the background check, but during the appeals process, the person can explain what has happened, and there will be a process to be fair to people. Finally, page 10 just shows you just an example of dozens of pages that our staff have to currently keep track of all the variation in rules, depending upon what subject you're dealing with different types of organizations. Are there any questions on the introduction or intent
any
of the
statute? Any questions of Dr. Monsager? Okay, if you don't mind standing by, we've got that amendment. You want to walk us through the amendment?
Yes. There are two amendments you have in front of you. We'll start with number 1, which, if adopted, would make this bill in the House side identical to the bill that was just adopted on the Senate side about an hour ago. And I'll talk through the changes, and Ms. Stacy Crayley is going to join me here at the microphone from the Department of Law.
It's 5405 in the right hand
corner. Another one that says 428-0.
Disregard that one.
Toss this.
Okay.
For the record, does anybody else need one?
Representative Groomer has tossed it.
Should we take a vote
yesterday
on it?
Yesterday, too.
Okay,
I apologize for all of the paper to the committee.
I'll go ahead and move amendment number 1. It's the big one with the staples, so that we have it properly before us, and then someone wants to
object for purposes.
So Representative Dahlstrom objects, so we can hear you explain it. Okay.
Okay. Chairperson McGuire and members of the committee, I'll walk through it and feel free to interrupt. The other document you have for reference is the second document that Representative Gruenberg was asking about that looked the same, and it just is a side-by-side comparison of the version Y that we're talking about today and the version that was just adopted in the Senate, in case you're interested. So,
the purpose of this amendment is to make this like the Judiciary and Senate bill, right?
Okay. Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, that's one purpose, but the other purpose is to answer a series of questions and corrections that have happened during the legislative journey. Number 1, page 1, line 7. And I'm just going to run down these as they're paged on your amendment there. This was added on the Senate side in the title because you can see the second one is that it was concerned that if a parent is coming to pick up a child at a child care place and if they've got an a locked firearm that's unloaded in their car to make it clear that they're not committing a crime by being on the child care premises when they are picking up the child.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bloomberg.
Did you say that this had to be locked in the trunk or something?
The way the Senate language is, it may possess an unloaded firearm in the trunk of a motor vehicle or encased in a container of a motor vehicle.
What does that mean, encased in a container of a motor vehicle?
Gun case.
Oh, a gun case. Ah, okay. May I inquire, would the gun case have to be locked?
Could it be, yeah.
The gun case, I have a gun case, and if it's unlocked, you just flip it open and you can use it.
Representative Groomberg, through the chair, the discussion on the Senate side was implying that it was locked. It doesn't say that.
Representative Dahlstrom also said maybe a glove compartment. Representative Groomberg.
I was wondering, is people concerned enough? Because a trunk is, you've got to unlock it. I am concerned because somebody could leave the car open and there's a gun case right on the seat unlocked. And there at the
Representative Dahlstrom.
Representative Groomberg, I know what your concern is, but you know, the flip side of that is what kind of attention are you drawing to yourself if every day you pull up to the daycare provider and you get out and you take your firearm and you carry it to the trunk and put it in and lock it and get your child in and go put it back. I mean, people don't carry a gun in their car they carry it for protection and they carry, you know, for various other reasons. And I guarantee you most of them aren't in the trunk.
And what if they found the key? Should it be a coded lock or should it be a keyed lock? You know, you could take it so far that maybe we need a subcommittee for this.
End of locking up the bill, right?
Mr. Monsucker, Dr. Monsucker, please continue.
Let me continue.
Get us past this point.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I got questions too. Yeah, I guess I don't understand the need for this amendment. How is this different than what the current law is? What's the current law is that you can't bring a firearm to a daycare facility?
That's the way it looks like it reads.
And I guess the question is, if we say that you can't bring a firearm to a school, why are we going to say you can bring one to a daycare facility, or do we let you bring an unloaded, encased gun to a school? I don't know the answer to any of those questions. So,
can you explain maybe the discussion that went on in the Senate?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the discussion during the Senate, and this is an amendment to Title 11, and I believe it's a misconduct involving a weapon in the fourth or fifth degree charge, and the discussion revolved around the issue of individuals being able to have an unloaded weapon in their vehicle when they go to pick up their children, and that was the qualifier, not the locked or the trunk or the encasement, but that it was an unloaded firearm. The discussion between on the committee dealt with the fact that they felt as a committee that was an important thing to be able to do and have the ability to do without fear of being charged with a misconduct weapon. We were neutral on the amendment. It passed. And anything further than that, I don't really know if I can answer the questions.
Okay, so the rule right now is that you can have a loaded weapon, obviously, but you can have an unloaded weapon?
Madam Chair, I'm not, to be perfectly honest, I'm not as familiar with the criminal code as I am with the licensing provisions of the rest of this bill, so I could not answer that question off the top of my head. I don't know what the criminal prohibitions are under Title
11. I understand. I mean, this is something that was tagged onto the bill in the Senate, so you're trying to defend it.
Madam Chair?
Representative Groomberg.
I think the current law apparently is at the bottom of page 3 of the bill, line 30 and 31, and goes up the top of page 4. You can't have it within the grounds of or on a parking lot immediately adjacent to, it's a center, but now it'll say an entity, other than a private residence licensed as a child care facility. And this will say that if you're over, if you're at least 21, you can have it in the trunk of your car or encased in a gun case. If the intent actually is to be a gun case, I would suggest that we call it a gun case rather than a container of a motor vehicle. Because a gun case isn't a container of a motor vehicle. It's a portable item that you can take, at least mine is. And so it's not, and that's why, Representative Anderson, I was, the use of the word of in there. Maybe that was intent to say, maybe you're talking about or encased in a gun case in a motor vehicle. I think that's probably what the intent was.
I think you're right.
I will, Madam Chair, I'm going to offer an amendment to the amendment.
Okay, well, let's do it right now, just so that we get it out of the way.
I think that this is going to be a conceptual amendment.
Conceptual amendment to the amendment.
And this is to the portion, page 4, line 3, the final line there where it says, encased in a container of a motor vehicle. I think that what we should say, encased in a gun case in a motor vehicle.
Amendment. This is an amendment to the amendment, Susan. So the amendment to the amendment, I think that's fair. I mean, it could be a container of, frankly, it could be a
pocket
food container or a, yeah, it could be anything.
Coffee.
Legos container. What do you think, Representative Dahlstrom? Can you think of any other kind of container that you would think?
Dr. Monsanger is like, I'm just a pediatrician. Why are we debating this?
Representative Gruenberg, where he's going and why? But I'm just having some problems with the practicality of.
Yeah. Well, tell me what your problem is through the chair.
What problem would you like to start with?
With this bill or others?
Now, none of us are doctors, but licensed in other fields, maybe.
You're thinking the practical part of it. I mean, who's going to run around with a gun case in their car? Is that what you're
going to do? Well, people carry guns, Madam Chair, for various reasons. And in our state, I mean, we've recently passed some bills that have caused some folks heartburn and have been a great relief to others that state law, you know, overrules municipal law on carrying of guns. And a lot of people carry them for self-protection. A lot of people live in areas where there's, you know, wild animals could be on their property at any time. And quite honestly, most of the people I know don't have their gun in a locked case in their car. And to be quite honest, most of them are loaded.
Madam Chair,
Representative Dahlstrom,
when they're talking, I just didn't know what's meant by in a container of a vehicle. Are you thinking they're talking about a glove box?
They possibly could be, and that's fine with me. I mean, I keep a loaded gun in there, and I can get.
I don't have a problem with that. I just, it sounds like this has to be part of the car. They're not talking about a portable gun case here. They're talking about something that's part of the car.
Yeah, you're right. It does say container of a motor vehicle.
And maybe they meant some kind of a glove, you know, because if I were a policeman or somebody, I wouldn't know what they're talking about here.
Would you feel more comfortable, Representative Gruenberg, if we simply said we're encased in a glove compartment or a locked gun case?
Sure, that's fine. Just so people know what it is. That's fine.
It's clear. I mean, I see your point, which is I don't think right now it leaves you room to put it in a gun container. It says encased in a container of a motor vehicle. Representative Guerra, my God, we're never going to get through this bill. We're on page one.
I think this is the wrong time to be debating gun policy, I think. But if we're going to change the law from what it is right now, where it was created by a committee that wasn't under the gun, like we are right now, I would be more comfortable, and my aide is going to look at this, I'd be more comfortable changing it to what the law is for school grounds right now. I don't know what the law is for school grounds, but until somebody convinces me that there's some different consideration for childcare facilities than school grounds, and maybe school grounds, maybe that's what this amendment does. Maybe it conforms it to what you can do on school grounds now. But I think we should at least see what we do on school grounds before we start coming up with a new amendment.
Sure, but I'd recommend we go through the amendment, yeah. And I know that you've been.
Let's just keep moving through the amendment. We'll come back to this.
I will withdraw that if I have made any kind of thing. But if we can remember this, then we'll come.
Okay. I'm hoping the rest of it's not going to be as controversial. And Stacy, will you just say your name on the record,
Stacy Crayley from the Department of Law.
Okay, page 6, line 31 through page 8, line 15. This was material that was put in during one version from Legislative Legal, decided it was wrong in the wrong place, and it's being taken back out again. And that's about all that's important to be said about that. The next two on page 12 and page 14 are important in my view, and these add phrases that the registry will contain this people that have committed medical assistance fraud or in our state or in a substantially similar provision, and it applies both to entities and to individuals. So, for example, I've been called by one of the providers in Representative Anderson's district where an employee of his said he was, and they billed Medicaid for a bunch of hours, the person didn't work, they had to pay double penalties back to Medicaid, and then the person went on to the next employer down the street and was doing the same kind of work. Page 16, following 11, this is an immunity section, so that if an entity or individual service provider gets information and then uses that as provided in the regulations for denying employment, they have immunity from suit for that purpose. But only if they've used it for that purpose.
Madam Chair, I'd like to know, this is Stacy Crayley again, I note for the record that this provision was, and you'll see a corresponding deletion further on in this amendment packet. It's been in the bill all along, but it was just in the wrong place, and we made the corrective change. So it's not a new section to the bill, it just is put in the right spot.
Okay.
So on the amendment package, then page 2, up at the top, page 21, line, or page 21, line 29, this is a result of discussions with some of the assisted living providers that were in town here a couple of weeks ago. They were worried that we can issue policies or procedures independent of regulation, and this makes it clear that what they have to pay attention to is rules that have been established in regulation that have gone through the regulation process, and we don't put out arbitrary rules outside of that process.
Can I ask a question?
Representative Gruenberg.
You, through the chair, Ms. Crayley, I think this is probably to you. Does this agency, the department, have to adopt its regs under the Administrative Procedures Act? Does that apply?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, yes, we do.
Okay. Page 23, line 30.
This one is also a result of discussions with the assisted living providers. They didn't think our language that was previously there was clear enough in terms of once they're licensed, in terms of their relationship with the department, and this clearly states that the issuance of a license doesn't obligate the department to place or maintain an individual. You can read that, and it's clearer language than was there previously.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
When you, and this is very technical, I want to be sure this is exactly right and not misinterpreted, where it says to place or maintain an individual in an entity or through an entity, or provide support to an entity, is it the intent to mean a specific entity as opposed to another entity?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, an entity is a defined term under the statute, and so an entity is all of the 18 listed entities that we will license, so it would apply to all.
No, that's not my question. Are you saying that it doesn't require you, being the department, to place a person in any entity or in entity A versus entity B?
I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, to any entity, not that we have no obligation. If an individual obtains a license for a home, we are not obligated to find residence for that home, that we're not going to maintain placement or authorize placement, that all we're dealing with is the licensure.
Okay. The reason I'm saying this is because sometimes people, and I have represented people in this kind of a situation, say, well, they placed my child in location X, the Ajax home, rather than the Bravo home. And, you know, they want to get down to that level. And I just want the record to be clear that you're immunized from any kind of a claim like that. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, it's not quite as simple as that. I mean, what we're dealing with here is ensuring that when we license an entity, that we are not obligated to subsidize, if you will, bad business practice, that if an individual can't operate a home or a nursing facility or what have you well, that we're not financially obligated to keep it operating or to to, or nor are they guaranteed to have individuals placed there. With respect to your specific question, which seems to track the process of a foster care situation, placement issues with respect to a child who's in foster care would be dealt with through Representative Coghill's HB 53 bill that we're working on.
It's the same principle. You're looking at immunizing yourself from claims by providers. Are you seeking here to immunize yourself from claims by clients too?
Through the chair, the Representative Grunberg, it's not necessarily an immunization for that purpose. But that's basically what we're trying to do. The provider.
Either one.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Go ahead.
Page 32, line 4, this answers Representative Grunberg's question. This corrects a mistake that was made earlier on to make sure that the Administrative Procedures Acts do apply.
That's page 32.
Page 32.
Okay, so that's through the chair. That's the entire rulemaking or adjudicated, quasi adjudicated?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that specific reference is to the quasi-adjudicatory process. It would be the administrative hearing procedures.
And this, you're using administrative law judges for this?
Under the Representative Grunberg, through the chair, the process is tiered. If you look at the bill, that for the most egregious type of sanctioning and licensing actions, we will use an administrative law judge. For the very minor, more technical sanctions, we have a much less informal process, so it's graduated.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Representative Coghill.
That takes care of the first two pages. We only have 14 more to go, or 13 to go. No disrespect meant, but time is going to really creep up on us here, and I suggest
we
take some of the hottest ones that are in this amendment and move along.
I think a lot of these are technical.
I think
to the extent that they're technical, that's a great idea. It does go to finance next. And
I think,
would you just state what's conforming?
All the rest of them are really, this is the end of them, with the exception of Amendment 2, which is a separate issue. The rest of these are really language issues and renumbering and so on and some more.
These look pretty smart.
Madam Chair, did you move the motion or do you want the amendment or do you want me to?
Representative Dahlstrom made an objection.
For discussion, which we've done.
Just only for discussion on the part dealing with firearms, that's language that's already in statute dealing with school areas. So I'm okay with that.
Me too.
Okay.
I would like to.
Objections withdrawn. Is there further objection? Representative Grunberg?
I'm just trying to quickly, in the words of our representative over there, go through this. It looks to me like we're deleting a few things, like on line 34, lines 27, 28. You're not including the definition of ambulatory surgical center, you're excluding facilities performing invasive diagnostic and therapeutic services?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, that was an idea of mine early on in the process. I added it in as a way to deal with the possibilities in the future as freestanding institutions move out of hospitals. After further discussions with both members of both bodies and with the hospital industry and with doctors, it became clear to me that it was impossible to narrow it enough to make it clear that we weren't intending to go license doctors' offices. And so this was really, as I understand it, was withdrawn in Hess, but it didn't get captured by legislative legal, and it got left in the bill. And at least my understanding of what Hess did was to take it out after I suggested that it was an attempt that didn't work.
Okay, further objection to amendment number 1? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 1 carries. That brings us to amendment number 2, which, as you said, is more of a substantive issue.
You want me to make that motion, Madam Chair?
Representative Anderson.
I'll move, I assume it's in blue, amendment number 2.
Amendment number 2 is the administration's request to remove section 54 and remove the phrase in the title dealing with the comfort care section that Representative Sisna discussed at the beginning of the discussion. The position of the administration is that Medicaid waiver issues and the scope of service, this isn't the appropriate bill to deal with that first. Second, a study is getting ready to be launched for this summer and fall to be completed by the time the legislature comes back next winter, looking at the whole scope of Medicaid waiver services and gaps and to be able to be in discussion with the legislature next year. Division Director Ashman's here sitting behind me, and if there are questions about it, he can answer more questions about it. But we would request that that Section 54 be removed.
I'm going to object, Madam Chair.
Representative Kira?
Yeah. I'm glad that the department's going to look at this, but my frustration is I spent a fair part of last summer trying to deal with some of the gaps that I think have been created in the waiver system. One is the reduction in respite care. One is what's happened to chore services. And I have a great concern that people who want to take care of family members or have family members with disabilities stay home are being forced into nursing homes. And Representative Sisson, I think, put together a proposal that tries to address this, and I just don't think it's good enough for me to hear that we'll address it next year. I feel like I've waited a year.
Through the chair to Representative Vergara. For the record, my name is Steve Ashman, Director of Division of Senior and Disability Services. What we did see with the effect of those regulations, obviously these services, the frequency of the services were reduced under those regulations. We have not seen, it's quite possible, but we have checked, and last we checked, we've not seen anybody that's been diverted from the waiver program and placed into an institution because of the changes in the regulations. What we have seen is some of the cost efficiency we anticipated that we'd get under the respite program were cost shifted over to the PCA program. We invested about $13 million in PCA clients that were also on the waiver program. Last fiscal year, once these regulations came along, our PCA budget for our waiver clients increased by $10 million. So I believe that that has cost shifted and helped many of the families under that circumstance. But we are doing a long-term care study. We're currently expending about next year it'll be about $260 million in long-term care services for about 6,000 unduplicated clients. And we want to make sure that the changes that we make are going to be good changes this time. We want to go and look at best practices and see what other states are doing to care for the seniors and vulnerable population in other states to make sure we do it right.
Okay, Representative Guerra?
Briefly, Madam Chair, I appreciate it, and I hope we do something by next year, but that's next year. And we've heard the cases of folks who have lost home care services. The reason they haven't gotten into nursing homes maybe is because families who want to keep their family members at home are just working that much longer, that many more hours, taking away that many more hours of their own free time to take care of family members at home instead of shipping them off to a nursing home. So I don't think it's a good indication that they haven't ended up in nursing homes. I think the most likely possibility is it's just been an additional burden on families. So. I object to the amendment to take this this provision out.
Okay, and I'm going to go ahead and support its removal at this time because of discussions with the department. But I agree with Representative Guerra, and I've already expressed that concern to your commissioner and to all of you that it really was frustrating this interim to try to communicate a message, you know, from our constituents and. It is three branches of government, but we're supposed to be the lawmaking branch, and we're supposed to be setting the policies, and then we pay for whatever it is that we set, and not the other way around, that you set it and then cut the budget that you request from us. And I sort of felt a little bit like that went on, and Joel and I have talked about it, and I expect and hope that relations will just continue to improve, and I've spoken with Representative Hawker, who's the budget subcommittee chair, about what the true intent was, both on the assisted living and on this, which there is an intent to cut some of this, for sure, in some of the abuses. And I don't know the full details, but my understanding is that there are some abuses, and then there are some places where it should be used as a tool. So I just hope we can keep up the dialogue, and I appreciate all the hard work that all of you, you know, have put into this. I know it's been frustrating, so I just want to say thank you for that. Okay, so Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on amendment number 2?
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Representative Cott?
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom? Representative Gruber?
No.
Representative Garrett?
No.
5 yes, 2 no.
So amendment number 2 carries. So at this time, this part of the bill is out, and I know that Sharon is working with Peggy Wilson, too, so we will anticipate. Okay, there's a third amendment by Representative Guerra.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I'd like to revisit for a moment here part of Amendment 1, just a question, if I may. I'm unfortunately a little behind the curve on this, and Doctor, I'm going to ask you, this is on page 3 down at the bottom, page 38, line 7, following 2 through line 15, deleting everything and inserting assisted living homes as defined in 4732-900, which tracks it back to the bill on page 34, line 29, through, let's see, page 35, line 14. And I've just been trying to go back and forth here and see if there's any substantive change. I can see you're wanting to track, it looks to me like what you may be doing is just tracking a previous definition, but I can't tell, is there any substantive difference there?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, this was answering another question. Assisted living providers noticed that we didn't have the identical language and definition of what was an assisted living provider, and so to clarify and make clear that it was the same throughout the bill, that was the intent. Stacy, do you want to add anything more?
My question is utilizing this earlier language rather than this later language, will that result in any way in any diminution of service to the client?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, the answer is no. This matches the current definition in statute for what's an assisted living home provider.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of slowly trying to listen and work through this real lengthy amendment, so I may come back from time to time with another question, if I might.
Sounds good. We're about to wrap up, so time to time should happen quickly, just so you're aware. Amendment number 3, Representative Guerra.
Oh, I'm sorry. I do have other question.
Okay.
We have a repealer, and under the Peter Gall theory, which we discussed the other day, I'd like to know at the bottom of page 3 what AS 2527244S2 is repealed. Is that a child support statute?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the purpose of that amendment was in response to alleged legal issue that was raised. And the reason for doing so is that at this time we are now, yes, it does deal with child support issues, I believe. But the premise is that we're licensing entities rather than individuals. And so what that was doing was allowing some garnishment issues. And there's another issue that deals with post-secondary education loans. And you can't garnish an entity for a loan default, but you can garnish an individual. And since we're licensing entities rather than individuals, that needed to be changed. Legal.
I'm not totally clear, but you sound like it's not an unreasonable suggestion. Okay, that's a trust me. I will.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number 3. It's the one that has the words starting at page 1, line 9, following services. That's the first sentence.
I'm not going to object to my own concept.
And let me just do an amendment to the amendment, and then I'll spread credit around the table. The amendment to the amendment is to take out subsection E. We want to establish a minimum room and board rate for assisted living homes, but I'm not comfortable not letting the department establish a maximum rate. So just the amendment to the amendment is to delete subsection E of the amendment.
That's at the bottom of page 1?
Yeah.
So first the amendment to the amendment. Does anybody have an objection to that? Hearing none, then that brings amendment number 3 as amended back before us.
And Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, myself, Representative Cisna, frankly a bunch of us, and maybe even more at this table, Representative Dahlstrom, I think, too, have had concerns about the reduction in the rates paid to help people stay at assisted living homes. And that reduction and what was essentially a transfer, and most of the people who are following this issue, I can talk in shorthand because we all know the issue too well by now. But the reduction went from $28 a day to $18 a day. You compensated for it by giving them $10 through the Medicaid program, which many assisted living homes feel they can't use legally. And so this amendment tries to roll back the new summer regulation to the former $28 a day compensation rate. And our understanding is the department is two things. Number one, the Senate has included funding so the department can roll back that regulation. And that's an amendment 37 to the current budget bill on the Senate side. And Madam Chair has worked very hard with others on getting that into the finance budget amendment. My concern, though, is until you adopt a new regulation, you can't spend this money. And so I think we're going to get a representation from the department that a regulation will be adopted rolling back this regulation so we can start compensating assisted living homes again at $28 a day. So I guess I'd like to hear from the department.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Agara, for the record, my name is Steve Ashman, Director of Senior and Disability Services. And what this amendment does is deals with the individuals that are have incomes in excess of SSI and APA, that $28 a day, if you will. We call them the 300 percenters. That would allow, this amendment would allow the clients to retain those caches for whatever purposes they use. If they choose to use them for room and board, then they may use those for room and boards. In discussions with the commissioner, if either the budget bill passes, instructing us to do emergency regulations, or if House Bill 288 passes, which with intent language to have us do emergency regulations to restore the cuts with an effective day of July 1st of next year, we will adopt those regulations, and I believe on an emergency basis.
And you just said effective July 2006.
What my understanding, if it's in the budget bill next year, it's the next fiscal year's budget bill, and it's not a retroactive. I'm dangerous there. I've not seen it.
Well, I guess if this budget bill passes as is with the additional money in it, I guess we want to know that assisted living homes are going to be compensated at $28 a day, like immediately, not 2006.
Through the chair, and maybe we'll let Stacy answer it. We're having a sidebar here. It's my understanding that if the effective date is July 1st, that's the date that we will make the regulations. And if the regulations don't become effective by July 1st, I guess we could go retroactive, Stacy, in reimbursement.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, my understanding of the discussions with the department and the commissioner's office that if we get the budgetary appropriation, that the monies will be paid to the assisted living home operators starting July 1st. And in lieu of the regulatory provision, we'll work as quickly as we can to amend the regs to state what they did a year ago with respect to the payment. But that's my understanding and the representations that have been made in other committee hearings.
Many members of this committee are going to be comforted by that representation, and I probably should be too. I'm going to move this amendment, and when I get something in writing from the department saying that the department is going to do that, then I'll be happy to withdraw it as this bill goes through the process. But I'd like to see the promise in writing.
Representative of Finance as well. Representative Groenberg?
Thank you, Mr. You know who I am.
I know.
Representative McGuire. I'm going to go back to my previous question, if I may. Can I? Okay, are we still on the Guerra Amendment?
Yes.
Okay, I'll wait.
Yeah, I guess my question is, Mr. Ashman, so, and what I think Dr. Monsagra said is he wanted a clean, I guess you will, licensing bill, and that was the point of it. I will agree not to vote for the amendment as well because I feel that you have in good faith satisfied all of my concerns. So that's the commitment I've made. But it would be nice to have something in writing, as Representative Guerra said, just explaining to us, because this regulation process is so complex, and frankly, when we tried to unravel it this last summer, you know, the more we unraveled, the more there was. And so if there's a way that from you, Steve, who we've worked with, we could just, or the commissioner, we could just understand the timing on these regulations, because Representative Guerra makes a good point that I hadn't
really thought about until the question was asked, which is that, you know, Amy and all the folks that were down here from the assisted living homes now have an assumption that if this money passes, they're going to be okay. So they're acting, if you will, they're already acting a certain way in order to stay afloat, so they don't close their doors. And I guess the concern would be if it weren't in effect until next summer of 2006, well, that doesn't help. And I know the money's intended for them starting now, but I wouldn't want them to be breaking the law either. So I guess we just want to know that, I understand you said emergency regs was how you're going to deal with it, but it'd be nice to have that in writing.
Through the chair, I'll talk with the commissioner on it. I know that we do have a commitment to follow through if the funding's there.
Good. Okay, so I think, so you moved it, so I'll object, as difficult as that is.
And I probably didn't say this on the record, this amendment was cribbed from an amendment that Representative McGuire and Representative Anderson did in the prior committee, I think, so.
Harder.
Now vote against it.
Governor. So, Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll on amendment number 3?
Representative McGuire.
The whole thing.
No.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
No.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Cogdell. Is not in the room. Representative Cogdell. Is not in the room. Representative Dahlstrom.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
No. Wait a minute.
No, you said no, but Representative.
Wait. Yes.
Representative Gruenberg, yes on amendment 3. Representative Garrett.
Yes.
3 yes, 2 no.
Okay, so the amendment carries. I don't know what you want me to do, Dr. Monsler, if you want me to call my members back, or if you want to try to take it out in finance.
It wasn't by Chairman Anderson, or I mean Representative Anderson.
What I wouldn't want to do is unravel. Let me take a brief, Eddie's. Confused, reading the record, we're at ease to awaiting a letter that gives us the Representative Guerra, in particular, the assurances regarding the regulations on the assisted living providers. And we will await that letter. And so we'll continue discussion. And then once we dispense with that, we can go ahead and set the bill right to the side, ready to move it out, take up workers' comp. And the minute you have it, I will interrupt workers' comp and go ahead. Okay? Representative Gruenberg.
Okay. We've adopted Amendment 1, have we?
Yes, we have.
Okay. I'm going to then consider it part of the bill. And that was without objection, right?
That was.
Okay. I'd like to go back to where I was on page 3,
okay.
Section, down at the bottom, the repealer for that section.
Okay.
If you look, we've handed out that section. This is the statute that allows you to pull people's licenses if they haven't paid their child support. It's a really important statute. And this will repeal all the definitions of licenses. And you can see if you take a look, the second page of the handout here, subsection S, it says in this section, and then number 2, license means everything. Driver's license is everything else. That was obviously not the intent, and I move to delete that from the bill. They can add it in a later section once they get this properly drafted. So, in other words, my motion, Madam Chair, on the bottom of page 3 of amendment number 1, to delete page 41 following line 2, insert a new bill section to read, quote, section 46 AS 25 27 244 S2 is repealed. Delete that.
And Madam Chair, I would object to amendment 4 so that the members of the Health Department can.
Okay. Ms. Crayley?
I didn't see any license that.
In the future, for anyone in the audience, Representative Gruenberg's rather focused on repealers this year. So if you have one in your bill, know what it means.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, in discussing this with my colleague from the Department of Law who's been working on these amendments, we have no objection to your amendment.
Okay. Good. We can't let a bill go out of here without an amendment from the great amender. Okay. So amendment number 4 carries. And so what we'll go ahead and do is set the bill to the side. I promise you it will get out today. And
And Stacy and Dick, just let me know, okay? So we will set House Bill number 193 to the side. We're going to take up workers' comp.
Hey, can you take a brief Eddie so I can discuss something? I'll save you a lot of time.
Okay, take a brief Eddie. Oh. For those of you that are here for Senate Bill 130, I really want to move through this quickly today. It's had extensive work the last year to 2 years by a lot of people, and I appreciate that. The reason that it was referred to the Judiciary Committee originally, first of all, it has to do with the fact that it's amending court rules, and second of all, there was a point in time where it would have changed certain structures in the court regarding appeals. So at this moment in time, it no longer contains that, but it does still have some court rules. That being said, for those who are here in the audience, I've got a timer. I'm going to limit folks' testimony to 3 minutes. I ask you to stay to that time limit. There's only one amendment so far that I have before me to reinstate the second injury fund. Other than that, there's no other amendment of consequence. So with that, we will, we're on version S, correct?
Madam Chair, I don't seem to have an amendment.
Representative Gruenberg. Representative Dahlstrom is going to make it conceptual, or do you want Vanessa to? She's going to make it conceptually.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. These versions have switched. In the Labor and Commerce Committee, it was version L, but now with the amendments that we passed out yesterday, we have a work draft S before us. Actually, not work draft, what we moved out of Labor and Commerce. So I don't think we have to adopt it as a work draft.
Nope. We've got S properly before us. And so is there somebody from the department that wants to present it? Mr. O'Cleary? Do you want to say anything about the bill?
Sorry. Madam Chairman, Greg O'Cleary, Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Really, my only comment is with respect to Representative Dahlstrom's amendment. The department supports that amendment. It was that particular problem was fixed in the Senate bill when it came over to you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. O'Cleary. Okay, next I have Joel Sigman in the MATSU. Joel, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, you've got 3 minutes.
All right. On that second injury thing, it's like you go in, you get released to go back to work, you get hurt, and then what, the bill's on you? That I don't think is right. Because they ain't taking care of the people in the first place on the first injury. I've been fighting it 8 years, and it's been nothing but a runaround. I can't read and write. I've been misrepresented all the way through. Workman's Comp Board will not tell you who can help you, and they tell you to sign papers without me knowing what they are. I had a guy named Scott McIntyre represent me there, and the Workman's Comp Board says, well, no, he's not allowed to come in and represent you. You got to come in by yourself. Well, I'm stuck with all these attorneys from the insurance companies and everything. And but yet they refuse to read everything to me and tell me what the thing's about. They tell me if you don't sign it, you're going to be cut off. And I've been fighting this for 8 years, and it's really sad the way the system's going. And if it's like if you do get released, I got a doctor saying I need surgery. Well, they refuse to do anything. Okay, I got documents on it, and then it's like if they do release you and you get hurt, well, what do? You guys don't want to. It's like you want the person to pay for it instead of the insurance companies. And I think if the insurance company doesn't do what they're supposed to do, I think you should be able to turn around and sue the employer. Because the insurance company is not doing what they're supposed to do to get the person back to work. I'm making peanuts now. I was making $4,000 to $5,000 a month before I got hurt. Well, I'd much rather be doing that, but there's no way possible anymore. So my whole life's destroyed, and I just don't know what to do, which way to go. and I can't see anything with the government where they're doing anything to help. And then the government, they take and workers' comp board pays back the insurance companies if the insurance company pays out the workers' comp board pays them back. Well, if you got in a car wreck, I don't see the state taking and paying back the insurance companies for an auto wreck. I mean, where's all this money going to the insurance companies from the state when they shouldn't have anything to do with it? It should be the insurance company, the employer, and the injured worker. But the thing is, we need attorneys up here that will fight it, because there ain't none. There's eight attorneys to fight for everybody in the state of Alaska for workman's comp, but they're all tied in together.
Thank you, Mr. Sigmund. I appreciate your testimony. I gave you an extra 30 seconds. Pardon me. I appreciate your testimony. Okay, next, Mr. Michael Blodgett or Blodgett or Blodgett?
Pick one you like. I've spent a lot of years dealing with it.
No, say it the right way. I want to know.
Blodgett.
Thank you. Please offer your testimony.
Okay, I've got a lot here to say. I'm going to try and say it very quickly.
You've got three minutes and 17 seconds to say it.
Okay, make a long story short, my wife was hurt 7 months ago. In her injury, or after her injury, I should say, workman's comp paperwork was filed with her employer. Her employer refused to turn it over to the insurance company. They made a lot of claims. It's taken 7 months for us to get through the system. In that seven-month period of time, she daily goes through what she describes to me as pain in her shoulder to the extent of what it would be like if a person were to shove an ice pick in your shoulder and then periodically move the ice pick around. Although I highly respect Workman's Comp Board and the attorneys on both sides, it's taken 7 months to get to this point. They recently said that we could cut a deal with the insurance company and the employer. However, we had to give up all fines, penalties, and fees. That didn't relieve the fact that I've got credit cards that are very close to being maxed out. I pay 21% interest on those credit cards, and they're quibbling over 4 or 5% interest. If you really want to change the system so it works, I've got a few suggestions. Number one, you're talking about a $10,000 fee that is paid, or a $10,000 fine that is imposed when there's problems with workman's comp, such as not filing. I suggest that's increased to $100,000. Make it a non-negotiable fine. Make it a fine that is split between the state and the injured party. That way the state can recoup some of their money while they're going through the workman's comp board. They can pay the workman's comp board, etc. Another one. And by the way, again, I'd like to reiterate, this is not negotiable. A 21% interest rate be imposed upon that $100,000 fine from the day the person is injured until the person is treated. I would like to reiterate again, it has been 7 months that my wife has been in pain while this has gone through the system. Next thing I would say is that medical costs are the responsibility, or should not be the responsibility of the employee. It should be the responsibility of the insurance company and the employer. Everybody's talking about fraud in the aspect that a person gets injured and the next thing you know they're working. It comes down to this. If my wife was not married, if I was not working, what would happen to her? We've spent 7 months waiting for this, waiting for my wife to be treated so she could go back to work. She has the option of either starving to death or going back to work if it was not for me. Now, I would like y'all to stop and think about this for a minute. And I've got an option here for you guys. As a matter of fact, I'm willing to put up a $100,000 home. But if to any person that's listening, a $100,000 home, my land, my property, everything but the clothes I'm wearing, I'll give it to any person that's willing to take and allow me to shove an ice pick in their shoulder and walk around for 7 months. Folks, this is the kind of system that we currently have in place, and this is the kind of system that we're allowing to continue. I suggest that Alaska quit following all the other states. I suggest that we quit being followers, start being leaders in the workman's comp area. Impose fines upon these employers that allow this kind of situation to occur. impose fines upon insurance companies that allow this kind of situation to continue. My wife is not the only one. Mr. Sigmund is sitting here next to me. He has spent the last 8 years in pain because of a system that is flawed. I applaud our legislators for taking this under their wing. I realize this is a very hot topic. I realize that it applies to a tremendous number of people. Insurance companies want to continue making money. People would like to get fixed. If we take and say, look, you're going to be putting out $100,000 for not taking care of these people per person, and maybe you will be able to get this to a stop and get the Workman's Comp Board slimmed down and their cases thinned out.
Thank you, Mr. Blodgett, and I am extremely sympathetic, and I do appreciate your testimony today.
I appreciate you taking your time to listen.
Thank you. Okay, next, I have Errol Champion. Mr. Champion? Welcome to House Judiciary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will be less than 3 minutes. I support Representative Dahlstrom's amendment to the Second Injury Fund. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of Alaska Timber Insurance Exchange. Second Injury Funds are extremely important for reemploying Alaskans, especially in the timber industry, and I hope that it's adopted and gets back into the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your brief testimony. Okay, Mr. Kevin Doherty. Defer to Dick Catnaugh in Anchorage.
Ms. Catnaugh is available in Anchorage. I would let him go first.
Okay. Mr. Catnaugh, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairman McGuire. My name is Dick Catnaugh. I'm the Executive Director of the Associated General Contractors, and I'm also the Management Co-Chair of the Ad Hoc Committee, Management Labor Ad Hoc Committee, and Mr. Doherty is the Labor Co-Chair. And I'd like to speak on behalf of the bill. This bill reflects about 6 months of hard work on the part of both employers and employees, and represents the first step of what I think will be a major overhaul in workers' compensation statute in the state of Alaska. So while the bill is far from perfect, it is a needed first step, and we do need a bill this year. Costs are continuing to escalate, and we can't continue to do nothing. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I do know you have in front of you the bill on the Second Injury Fund, and the Second Injury Fund is a system that isn't working. It hasn't worked for a long time. It's a very expensive system. If you are a good employer and you hire somebody, you can't ask them the questions that's essential to get into the Second Injury Fund, and that is, does he have a pre-existing injury? Because it's illegal to ask that question under federal law. And if you don't ask that question, you're not entitled to use the Second Injury Fund. So we don't have many people getting into the Second Injury Fund at all, and it's just a system not working.
Mr. Catnaugh, on that subject, because there'll be an amendment forthcoming, can you explain to me then, so you're saying that by law, of course, when you're interviewing somebody, you obviously can't ask about their religious preference, their political preferences, all these types of things, and you're saying you can't say, do you have an injury that would cause a limitation in a certain area? Is that what you mean, that you can't ask about physical injuries or physical limitations?
That's correct.
Okay, and so then that's question number one. And then number two, then what triggers entry into the Second Injury Fund?
Well, when the person is injured, injures a pre-existing injury, that would be what you would call the second injury. But for an employer to use the Second Injury Fund, you had to have knowledge of that injury before you hired him and put him into that position. And you can't have that knowledge under federal law. So, therefore, you're almost precluded. I'm not sure how people are getting into the Second Injury Fund now. There are only about 130 people, I think, currently receiving payments, and some of those have been in the system for over 20 years. So you can see we probably only have, according to Paula Sankey, anywhere between 5 and 10 new cases a year that are added to the Second Injury Fund. of all the injuries we have in the state, that's all that, that qualify.
Okay, and so how much, do you happen to know, Mr. Kettner, how much money is in this fund right now?
It's between somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 and $4 million.
Okay, and then my final question is, how much is it a percentage that the employer is required to put in based on each employee, or is it a lump sum that the employer pays every year based on the number of employees total they employ, or how is an employer assessed an amount that goes into that fund?
The insurance companies are assessed, I think it's 6% of, and I'm not sure, I think it's 6% of the indemnity payments they make. So it amounts to another tax on the employers of about 2.5 to 3% on their premium.
Okay, thank you very much. Question? Any other questions for Mr. Kettner?
No.
Okay, no questions? Okay, thank you very much for your hard work on this, Dick.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. Would you mind, sir, if we brought someone back up to the table to
yes.
comment on what was just stated so we can get some
yes, that's fine.
Answers to that?
And for the Department of Health and Human Services, just so you know, I'm going to finish. Go ahead and come up, Mr. Champion. I'm going to conclude public testimony. Reserve questions, please. Set workers' comp aside for 2 minutes. Bring it back up again. Read the letter into the record. And then move your bill out, okay? Mr. Champion.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Earl Champion, and I'm a director with Alaska Timber Insurance Exchange. We're a company that provides workers' comp coverage. As far as understanding previously injured employees prior to employment, there's nothing that prevents an employer from asking for a physical. You cannot discriminate because of an injury, but there's every opportunity to go back into the employee's life through a pre-employment physical or even after he's employed. So it can be identified. It's just not not factual that you can't ask about a pre-existing condition.
Boy, I wish there was. Are there any attorneys, any workers' comp attorneys in the room? There's one there. Good, because I want to ask Mr. Lisinski then. Mr. Lisinski, if you could, because sorry to put you on the spot here, although you didn't even sign up to testify. Did you give everything you had to work to Labor and Commerce?
Oh, there's always a little bit
you
more.
A little bit for judiciary.
For the record, my name is Paul F. Lisinski. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Thank you very much. My question is this. Is there a nuance here? Then I understand the idea that Mr. Kettner said employers in practice, at least as he's saying, are not asking these questions because they can't, by definition, by law, factor into their hiring decisions. That being said, if you were to do a pre-employment physical or screen in any way and then make a decision not to hire an individual, is that then grounds for the employee to come back and say, well, this screen, this physical, if you will, uncovered something, and I think that's the reason they didn't hire me. That's my concern.
Madam Chairman, I haven't really dealt with that all that much myself, but my understanding, based on talking to other people, is that it's basically a fear of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they don't want to go into it. So they avoid doing things before the hire that they might have done before, but what you can do to qualify for the Second Injury Fund still is you can prove it up after the hire. So what happened was the legislature, after the Americans with Disabilities Act passed, the legislature went into the section of the act that addresses this and said, all right, well, it may not be okay to ask before the hire, but if you can prove that you retain someone in employment, notwithstanding this pre-existing condition, you can still qualify for the Second Injury Fund protection. So it is true that it's got a lot of hoops that you have to go through, but obviously it can still be done, and there are people that would testify that they take advantage of it.
Okay, and Mr. Lisinski, you may or may not be the right person to ask this question, but what is a worker's remedy who does have a pre-existing injury and then has the second injury? And let's say that this committee kept the LNC version and there were no second injury fund. What is that worker's remedy?
Well, Madam Chair, the remedy, the second injury fund is not really a remedy for the for the injured worker. It's a remedy for the injured worker's employer or their insurer. So what it does right now is it reimburses the insurance company after they pay a certain amount of benefits, and then the fund picks up the rest. So if there was no fund, then it would remain on the shoulders of the insurance company for the entire life of the claim.
So this amendment is to help insurance companies?
No.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
You'll explain it, because while we're on it, I want to understand it.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. The workers' comp law currently, and Mr. Lisanky, correct me if I have a misunderstanding here, contains a provision that's known as the last injurious workers.
Last injurious exposure rule,
Okay, correct. So under this law, if the employees had injuries previously for a different employer, and that contributes to a disability, and then they go to another job and something happens that maybe makes that worse or brings out the injury that was already there, then that last employer can be held liable.
That's correct. That's correct. So when the court, when the Alaska Supreme Court was looking at adopting that rule, they recognized that it might not be equitable in every situation to give all the responsibility to that final employer. And one of the reasons that they found it was less inequitable is they said, well, the second injury fund exists, and therefore that last employer will only pay for a limited period of time, and then the second injury fund will kick in, so it's really not so harsh. So that is one of the justifications, you're correct, for the last injurious exposure rule, is the existence of the second injury fund.
And Madam Chair, just for the record, too, I'd like to state that I've had a little bit of personal experience with this, and that is, working in a management-level job where I wasn't working in the field or doing anything that had manual labor, I was required to, when I was hired, to sign a letter stating that I would undergo a physical and that my continued employment was dependent on how that physical came out. And it wasn't the most thorough physical I've ever had in my life, but, I went through the process, and they basically told me, you passed the physical, we're going to make your job, official now. So they were very legal, followed that process, and...
Good. Okay. Representative Anderson?
Just super quick. So just hypothetically then, thanks, Jen. So... if someone, let's say they're, I can't think of the capacity, they're working where they're moving boxes in their first employer, and they screw up. But of course, the employer's, generally with the system, the employer is going to be liable to some level for that. And so they pay through workers' comp, employer pays through workers' comp, person leaves, they go on to the next place where they might have to move, let's say in a storage company or supply building, and they go to the next company. Now, how would this work when they screw up again due to their own fault? Ultimately, the employer will have to pay. Would it be the first employer? Would it be the second employer? Would it be a mix? Will it be the second injury fund?
Okay.
I'm being a little sarcastic, by the way.
Representative Anderson, through the chair. The apportionment of who would pay is based on a legal test, and the existence of the second injury fund doesn't really make a difference as to who pays. We have a very liberal standard for in most instances it would be the second employer, unless what happened at the second employer was not a substantial factor in bringing about the disability. And it doesn't take that much normally factually to establish something as just a substantial factor as opposed to the major factor or something like that.
And then just second question, Madam Chair, thank you for your latitude. Then if Representative Dahlstrom's amendment passes, then what happens in the hypothetical I gave?
What happens is, as long as there is a second injury fund, if that second employer has gone through all the hoops that are necessary to qualify that employee, and they have to have certain conditions, not every disabling condition qualifies. They have to have it in writing. There's a Supreme Court case that says you can't just know. If I show up missing an appendage, that's, and I know it because I see it, it's still, I need to have the document. The employer needs to have it written. If you have all that qualification done and that person gets injured to the point where the second injury so disables them that they're off work for more than 2 years, typically, then the rest of their time loss benefits would be reimbursed to the employer, or if they're insured, to the insurer out of this fund. That's what the fund does. It reimburses after 2 years. So you pay a lot of benefits before you get anything, and you do have to pay for medical benefits, notwithstanding the existence of the second injury fund. But it is true that the cases that you see being paid from the second injury fund are people who, due to the second injury, no matter how small or large the injury is, are getting paid benefits, usually for life. They're usually permanent total disability benefits. So they can be very expensive cases, which is why it's entirely true that there's only about 130 of them, but we it's a grants line item out of our division, and it's about $3 million a year right now that's being paid out. So, I mean, it's substantial.
And then, Mr. Zinke, what do other states do as an alternative to that? If, let's say we adopted the LNC version, we conceded what Dick Katnos said, that it wasn't working, and what are the other alternatives? What do other states do?
Madam Chair, what a number of states have been doing is they stop having the second injury fund, and they try and redirect some of those dollars to some other program that's oriented towards trying to get people back to work after they get hurt. The second injury fund takes a little different approach, the idea being to avoid discrimination. That the employer will be more likely to employ you if they know that they have a fallback position than if they don't. So the second injury fund tries to take it from the approach, well, people will discriminate against people with injuries unless we soften the blow to them should they employ this person and then there's a second injury. The alternative would be, well, let's just hope that they get hired, or let's have laws that require you to hire them, and then if they get hurt, let's try and get them back to work somehow. Hmm. That's sometimes easier said than done, obviously.
And then my final question, when you said that this affects 2 to 3%, is that what someone said, of workers' comp rates right now?
I didn't say that. I heard that also. I just know the gross amounts.
Dick Katnos said that, yeah. Dick, are you still there?
Linda Hall here.
Yeah, she was here.
Well,
Linda Hall may be able to
address
it. Okay, Dick, so you said that the second injury fund itself amounted for 2 to 3% on current employer workers' comp rates?
Yeah, and just that may be a little high. Our total premiums, I think, are about $220 million. So using Paul's number of $3 million, that would be about a percent, just short of 2%, between 1% and 2%.
Okay. And everybody pays it. I mean, all employers pay it.
Madam Chair, the way that it's assessed is everyone that has to pay workers' compensation benefits, I mean, it's assessed based on the amount of benefits that are paid in a period of time, in a year's time. So if there's, say, $40 million for all the employers and all the insurers that are paid this year for time loss benefits, then there's a scale from 0% to 6% based on our balance. It's been pegged at the maximum for the last few years and probably will be. So it would be 6% of the $40 million. Each dollar you pay in a benefit, there's another 6 cents that you have to pay to the second injury fund. That's the way that the second injury fund gets the money that's then distributed to reimburse.
Okay, I completely get it now. Okay, thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Lisinski? Thank you.
I'm sure.
Two more people. Oh, Representative Cott, my apologies.
I was after.
My apologies, Representative Cott. My apologies.
Yes, sir. Dick Cottenau made a statement that the second injury fund doesn't work. Can you comment on that, in your opinion?
To try and keep my opinion short, through the chair, Representative Cott, it's a system that has a lot of hoops that you have to go through to qualify to get anything out of it. And it can be very difficult to get all of the things in line to qualify an employee to get anything out of it. So if the statement is, does this affect a lot of people, does this really help a lot of people year in and year out, I guess the answer would be probably not. But some of those people, the idea is some of those people wouldn't have gotten the job unless their employer had the security of knowing that if they were really going to incur this big liability, that they'd get bailed out of it. I mean, that's the focus of the Second Injury Fund and has been for the many years that it's been invented. You can certainly make an argument that you can try and do something else that might have broader application, but the theory behind the Second Injury Fund has been pretty much that for, you know, in every state for many years, is that you just try and soften the blow to people, to employers of people who come to the workplace with a serious injury and then get seriously injured.
Madam Chair, just to continue the line of questioning, comment was also made by, I guess it was Mr. Cattenau, that at least in his opinion, he thought this piece of legislation is the first step in a major, I don't know, reform or major overhaul of the system. Is there anything in this bill, and you've had it, I guess, almost 24 hours to look at it. I've been looking out so it comes out of my ears, but in the time you've had, is there anything in the bill from the division's perspective that is genuinely onerous and impractical or unworkable?
I don't think I would characterize any of the provisions using those words.
Boy, he's a politician in the making.
Okay. Ask it differently.
Representative Cott.
In which words would you qualify?
Then, Madam Chair, I guess maybe the pointed question is, has the division taken a position on the bill?
Representative Cott, through the chair, I think that's occurring at a higher pay grade than mine.
Lysenki, U.S. Senate.
Final question.
I don't mean to be.
Okay, we're going to set this bill aside right now and bring up House Bill number 193 so we can get it out of here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
We have a technical thing I need to do on my amendment.
Okay.
I would move that we rescind.
Max is amending his amendment. Oh, you're going to rescind your amendment.
And I'm going to put something. They left part of the language out.
Move to rescind amendment number. Do you remember which number? 4. Madam Secretary, the motion is to rescind amendment number 4. Okay. Is there an objection to the amendment's author rescinding his own amendment?
There is
personal privilege. Representative Guerra.
Yeah, there is. There's. I know people want to move quick. I'm just not 100% sure the letter that we got is the letter.
Let's get to that. Just for this is Max rescinding. Okay, is there an objection to him rescinding his own amendment? Okay, hearing none, that amendment is rescinded. New amendment 5. Okay.
And this now amendment number 5 on the bottom of page 3 of amendment number 1. The council, who I don't know where they are. The council's around here somewhere. Anyway, there they are. Stacy's here. They left out part of the statutory site. If you would look at your handout here, they only wanted to repeal one line in this whole definition, and it's B little II on the middle of the third final page of the amendment. That is the license issued under AS 47.35, and the reason for that, if you will look at section 50 of the bill itself, that whole chapter is basically repealed, and that is on page 41 of the bill. Section 50 repeals every section in that chapter. And Jean Michel informs me they have to set out everything. They can't just say chapter 35 of Title 47. So my amendment, Madam Chair, is to the statutory site on, it should be section 46, AS 25.27.244, paren small s, paren 2, close paren, and now we add this. Paren capital B, paren small II, close paren, is repealed. So we add paren capital B, close paren, paren II, close paren. That's amendment 5.
Amendment 5. I'll record that for Vanessa. Okay, is there an objection to that? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 5 carries. Representative Guerra.
Madam Chair, so that he can object, I think we should be able to move the bill and then let him.
Yeah, what we need to have a motion on the table is to rescind our action in adopting amendment number 3 by Representative Guerra, which would put the regs, the repeal of the assisted living home regs into this bill. And while you were out, Representative Coghill and Cott, the discussion was that the department was going to do that. That's the money in the Senate Finance Committee and the House Finance Committee, and they're going to do it by dollar amount and by language. Representative Guerra didn't feel satisfied by that, so the amendment was voted on and carried in a 3-2 vote. It's now in the bill, and then the statement was made, if we came back and gave you a letter assuring you that we were going to do what we said we'd do, would that be okay? And because you guys were gone and there wasn't a vote for it to go the other way, I set it to the side, and that's where we are now. So I'll go ahead and make the motion, amendment number 6, I guess it's just a motion to repeal our action on amendment number 3, and then obviously you'll object, and then let's discuss it.
Object. I think Mr. Eshman and I might be close to the language on the letter that we need. I guess let's hear from Mr. Eshman.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Guerra. The language that I have in there, by deleting that paragraph, essentially restores the issue is around people that had incomes in excess of the SSI and APA rate. The homes used to be able to retain those dollars. The client used to be able to retain those dollars for any purpose they wanted, whether that's to pay additional rent to the providers, whatever the case may be. By eliminating that, anybody has income in excess of that, we go back to the way it was, and they can spend those dollars any way they want. There is no contribution to care cost for those clients. With respect to your concern over the 262, we are already paying the 262 to providers. That will continue, the 362 to those providers through the Medicaid reimbursement rate. And I've already been on record and officially on numerous cases indicating that they can spend those funds any way they want. We've changed the way that we price out assisted living. We added the 262 under the APA refinance, and they can expend those funds for any purpose they want. And I've written letters to many representatives here as well as in the Senate and to the clients about that. But this essentially pulls back the regulation that we adopted last year so that the clients are able to retain all of the income that they have.
It's the 300 percenters.
That's the 300 percenters.
Now, Representative Guerra, you may have a different issue, but your amendment anyway addresses the 300 percenters. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. What I want to make sure of is that the former process, which is that that residents got $362 a month in APA payments, those who were entitled to that amount, the former rule was then they could use that money for room and board. The new regulation took $262 a month away from those people and reimbursed and then allowed assisted living homes to use that money through Medicaid payments, which is what caused the big flap. My understanding is that if the funding goes through, that the assisted living, the APA payments will go back up to 362 for those who used to be qualified for it, and that money can be used for room and board again.
Through the chair, and perhaps Stacy can help me with this one, but no, that's not the case. I think that we want for our SSI, our APA recipients that we were funded through 100% general funds, I think that we want to retain that Medicaid refinancing and the cost shift that we did last year. What this does is free up for those 300 percenters all excess funds that they can spend any way they want. The 262 is already being provided to the through the recipient, through the Medicaid program, to the assisted living home provider, just as it was prior to the regulations.
Chair, I know that we have to run, and so I know you want to move the bill out. I think I still have a concern that we're not on the same page, that we're on a different page than I thought we were when we started this. And with the bell ringing, I guess I don't know what to do other than to sort of end the conversation because I don't want to keep people here.
And I hope members will support me in rescinding this at this time. That doesn't mean that I won't continue the conversation with you. This goes to finance next. And they have so far for me followed through with the parts of the good faith that they've agreed to, not only in the House, but the commissioner went above and beyond and actually got the Senate to put it in their side. So I just want to let you know that my door is open for you to continue the discussion, and let's make sure we get it all clear. We've got one more committee, should that not be the case. But I really would like to send it out clean, as I promised today, and move forward. But it's your decision. So
I'm trying to work as quick as I can to get the language to work out well, and I thought it would be easier. And I can't, so I want to leave the amendment in as a hammer.
Okay, so I made the motion to rescind our action on amendment number 3, and is there any further debate? Okay, Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on rescinding our action on amendment number 3?
Representative McGuire?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Representative Cott?
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom?
Yes.
Representative Broberg?
No.
Representative Garrett? 5 yes, 2 no.
So that brings the bill back before us. Is there a motion?
Does that not bring the amendment back?
No. Senator action. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the CS for Senate Bill 125, excuse me, 193, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay. Objection? Do you want to object?
Just briefly, oh, and yeah. Also an attached letter.
An attached letter dated 5505 from Mr. Ashman, Director, Division of Senior and Disabilities. Okay, so is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, it moves. Thank you very much. Sure, appreciate it.
And can you make a copy of that?
Okay, we're back to workers' comp. And so where I left, yeah, there is an amendment, but let's just complete the two final folks to testify. They may or may not want to talk about the amendment, and then we can go ahead and dispense with, discuss the amendment. Okay, so Senate Bill 130 is back before us. Did somebody just take my sheets? Where are they? Okay, there they are, stuck in the other file. Mr. Kevin Doherty. Okay, Mr. Jim Robinson. Okay, anybody else here in the audience to testify in Senate Bill number 130? Anybody online that I've overlooked? Okay, public testimony is closed on Senate Bill number 130. That brings the bill back before us. Representative Cott.
Chair, I wonder if we could have Mr. Woolover answer a question.
Mr. Woolover.
There seems to be some concern that what was taken out was something you may not want to have done.
Do you need a copy? Max, could you give us the doc?
Madam Chair, Mr. Wilbur, during an earlier version of this bill, it was a House bill, there was an issue that was of concern to you, dealing with the Appeals Commission. Can you relay to the committee what that concern was?
Sure. For the record, my name is Doug Woolover. I'm an administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. Many earlier versions of this bill and the bill from the last special session, the bill from the session before that, had a provision in it that would bypass the Superior Court and send all of the appeals from the agency directly to the Supreme Court. The rationale, there were several rationales for that. One of them was that it would speed up the process, but I don't think that it would speed up the process. And there are a couple of reasons for that. Most of the cases that get appealed to the court system each year stop at the Superior Court level. We average about 34 cases a year coming to the court system. Almost all of those don't go on to the Supreme Court. About 8 a year go on to the Supreme Court. If you bypass the Superior Court, you bypass the faster court and send them to the slower court. The Supreme Court takes about an average of 20 months from the time you file your case until the court issues the opinion. The Superior Court takes about an average of a year, or even less than a year. So you're moving a whole bunch of cases to the Supreme Court that will take a lot longer than had you left them in the Superior Court in the first place. You will save time on those that do get appealed to the Supreme Court because you've cut out the middle appellate provision court, which is the Superior Court in this case. But most cases won't take a year now. Most cases would take 20 months. And that was one of our concerns. Plus, you have the problem of the Supreme Court. Anytime you increase their caseload, you necessarily slow down the rest of the work that's before the court, because the same five people have to hear every case that comes to them. And so it would end up slowing down the work of the Supreme Court and take longer for each of the cases. That was our concern.
Any further questions for Mr. Wolver? Okay, thank you for your testimony. Okay, so the
Representative
Gruenberg.
There has been some concern as to whether the Superior Court has as much expertise in these areas as administrative law judges would have.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. Well, as you know, Superior Court judges are judges of general jurisdiction. They hear every kind of case. You could always have a some type of specialty court with unique experience in a particular area that could develop greater expertise than any particular Superior Court judge. But I guess that argument applies to every single case that comes before the court. I was reading a description the other day of some testimony before the legislature on when, how do you think it had to do with oil companies' duties to develop and what the court has to look at in those cases. It's an incredibly complicated formula of economic analysis and world development practices and all of these other things. And I was thinking to myself, if a Superior Court judge can understand all of that, I think they can find their way through a workers' comp appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Wolver. Okay, so that brings the bill back before us. Senate Bill number 130, and we have one amendment, Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, and my amendment is that we, conceptual amendment number one, that we add the second injury fund and insert it in the appropriate places of the bill.
Okay, I'll object, just or Representative Anderson, just for discussion. Representative Dahlstrom, you've made your arguments, right? I mean, is there anything you want to add?
Really, just in closing, I just think this provides a needed leveling mechanism for business so that, any one of us could own a business and hire an employee to do any number of tasks, and something happens and we are ultimately then responsible for them as far as the workers' comp goes. It could devastate our business, and I just think it's a leveling mechanism.
Any other discussion on it?
I would just say, for the record, Madam Chair, that Mr. Catanaugh has stated with respect to the maker of the amendment that he opposes that as the management chair of the ad hoc committee. I mean, we've certainly, Labor and Commerce, every single thing we did was per the ad hoc committee in terms of amendments and everything. We passed it right out. Now there's a disagreement in the chairs of the committee, and I side with Mr. Catanaugh. But secondly, a question arose, which I don't know if we can answer in the committee now, but the question is, it's very expensive what, if this amendment goes through, in terms of the fund and long-term expenses, as has been testified. There's a difference of possibly philosophy whether it should go in or not. But a question came to mind, which is, if Representative Dahlstrom's amendment doesn't pass, who will bear the burden of the cost? Will it be the insurer, who will then offset the cost to the employer, in this the hypothetical, the second employer where the injury occurs, or will there be an offset somewhere else? And I'm not sure what the answer is, but I'm going to rely on Mr. Catanaugh in rejecting the amendment at this point.
Any other discussion on it? Representative Guerra?
No, Madam Chair. There's the lingering question. I mean, in addition to everything Representative Dahlstrom talked about, there's the lingering question I guess I don't know the answer to, but I wonder whether eliminating the second injury fund might have an unfortunate effect on premiums for some employers who will have to take in previously injured employees without the promise that they'll be covered by the second injury fund. And I don't know. I'm not going to get an answer to that question, but I support the amendment.
I'm going to go ahead and support it at this time because it's brought by Representative Dahlstrom, and I don't know enough about it. I've heard arguments on both sides. I look forward, you know, to the debate continuing, but it sounds like it's an important enough component at least to consider discussing. And so, Representative Coghill?
Just a reasonable question has arisen in my mind that we have a Supreme Court ruling that also says that if we don't have this fund, then the last employer bears the responsibility, which gives me great concern that unless we devise something that can answer that Supreme Court question, I don't know that it just taken it out. I mean, it may be proper to take it out, but without an answer that I feel that we've been able to get to. So I'm going to support it.
Okay, so Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on amendment number, I guess it's 1.
Representative McGuire.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Cott.
No.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Bura.
Yes.
5 yes, 2 no.
Okay, so amendment number 1 carries. Are there further amendments to Senate Bill number 130? Okay, Representative Anderson.
I'll make the motion that we move Senate Bill 130 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Looks like it's version S out of Judiciary Committee on to Finance Committee.
Hallelujah.
I'll object.
Hey, there's an objection. Representative Potts, speaking.
Madam Chair,
objection.
I'm not prepared to move, vote this out today. I'm not saying that it won't move out shortly, but I think there's a couple of questions that I still need to resolve. One is where the position of the department or the governor is on this bill. And number 2, with that latest amendment, I need to be very, very sure that what the sponsor is trying to do is going to be done. And I think if you can go back through the iterations of these workers' comp bills over the last year and a half, this injury fund, second injury fund, has been in, it's been out, it's been in, it's been phased out, and then now it's back in. So there's been a myriad of flip-flopping here. So I just want to be sure that those two questions are answered. We still have plenty of time, Madam Chair. We have 5 days and only one more committee to go through with this, as long as it's on the floor by Saturday. I think we're fine.
All due respect, I'd like to get it out because I've got an inventory of 10 other bills I have to get to, including the ethics bill, which is headed our way. So. But I respect your thoughts deeply, and I hope we can get it out today. And I think the conversation will continue. And if there are other things brought up about the second injury fund, I'd love to hear them. But I mean, at least the testimony today made me feel more like it should be in than out. But Representative Anderson,
thanks, Madam Chair. I would just ask that members consider precedentially what we've done this session in this committee, which is when there is another committee of referral, and I look at my friend Representative Crawford, Labor and Commerce, generally we have that same protocol. There's another committee of referral that can answer those questions, and tomorrow's Friday session is going to end quick. It's the governor's number one priority, and I don't think these are, Mr. Lysenki, Representative Cott, was in Labor and Commerce, so he's one that should know the bill better than anyone. He's the one that helped draft it. I would hope that he would support the chair's wishes, which is to move on to finance, which is what we've done consistently for the whole session. I mean, this would be the first time we haven't done that.
And don't take any personal offense.
Yeah.
But Secretary, we call the roll on the movement of Senate Bill 130 out of this committee.
You're a drafter, brother.
I know it. That's why I want
to. Representative McGuire.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Cott.
No.
Representative Dahlstrom?
No.
Representative Gruenberg?
No.
Representative Garrett?
No.
This committee's adjourned.